Good morning. You've arrived at Listen Local, the biweekly webcast from your neighborhood news source, Mission Local, brought to you via BFF.fm. I'm Joe Ravano-Barros, and with me today are my colleagues Laura Wenis and Laura Waxman.
Good morning.
Good morning,
hey.
Guys.
Two of us today.
Yeah. Switching seats. And today we'll be talking about the District 9 race first, I guess. So there are six candidates for District 9.
Yeah, and you've been talking with each of them extensively, right? If I understand correctly.
Pretty extensively. I mean, more or less. I've been talking to the ones I know better more, which is probably my bad. But I'm getting to all of them slowly, surely and slowly. But yeah, and the newest one, just announced last week, is a formerly homeless app maker who created an first brought Wi-Fi to a bunch of shelters citywide and then created an app that he hopes to use to connect homeless people to city services.
Wow.
So he just threw in his hat and we'll see how it goes. I mean, any thoughts on how this is shaping up?
Well, he just really caught my interest because I even like some of the things that he said, you know, in your story as you were interviewing him. He said that he plans on having the thriftiest campaign of all of the candidates.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting.
I thought that was great. But also, I mean, what do you think? He said $10 a pop. That's it.
$10. He doesn't want to owe anybody money, right?
Right.
Is that what that was?
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting and sounds to me very similar, like sort of echoes something we're seeing in the presidential primaries at the moment. I'm thinking of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
In case that wasn't abundantly clear.
Small donations.
Yeah. Small donations. I don't want to be on the take from larger interests with lots of money.
And he seems to be really real about, you know, his chances. And he even said, you know, I probably won't make it.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, it was funny. He did say that to me. And then when I first called him, like, oh, so you're running. And he said, no, I'm not running. I'm going to win. Like, he was very adamant that he was going to win this race. And I think that's true for all of them, even.
Well, that's just like standard campaign rhetoric, right?
Yeah, of course.
Everyone has to say that.
Don't want
to look weak. Yeah, exactly.
But I don't know, $10, $10 limits. I don't know if he's going to raise enough money for that.
When I feel like, Joe, you're more of the expert in that. You know, what does that realistically mean?
Right. I mean, like, so the campaigns have a $500 limit per individual, per donation. So $10 is, like, limiting yourself to that is really tough.
And that includes, you know, flyering and people.
So, yeah, all that money will pay for flyering, volunteers going door to door, like, ad time, ad space, you know, everything, campaign staff. So, I mean, they're already, candidates already complain about the $500 limit. So for you to, like, on your own, limit yourself to $10 is brave.
Well, it means you expect an extremely broad supporter base.
Right.
You expect lots of people to know about you, first of all, which is tough given that he just entered the race. I think he was the last candidate of the six, holy crap, that we have in this race
he
now
is the last,
to enter. And you know, now he has to catch up. He has to make up for the publicity gap, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and I thought, so one of the things that I thought was like, oh, is this the year of the outsiders? Like, we have a bunch of people just throwing in their hats, like running for this race. And I talked to Jim Stearns, who is a progressive political consultant, and he said, you know, no, this is an open race. So Campos is termed out. So whenever you have an open seat, everybody runs. So this is not unusual to see these kinds of candidates who are not well known, don't have as much money or, you know, political endorsements, that they're just coming out of the woodworks to see what they can do.
Yeah.
So speaking of the other candidates that aren't well known, there are two.
Yeah.
Who are they?
So the other ones, and there is Zuari España, who works at the Human Services Agency as a job training officer, and he's been there for a while. And he's been in the mission for a while since he was a kid. He moved from, I want to say, Guatemala. And he's gotten started. I mean, you can see his flyers already around the neighborhood, mostly around 24th Street, because that's where he lives. So he's hitting the ground running, and he's at all these, like, housing meetings, community meetings. He went to all the Alex Nieto stuff.
Well, so does, like, everybody else on the
But he's, like, consistently there. I mean, like, for instance, like, all these like shitty little meetings that I have to go to for housing,
like pre-app meetings.
He's there, and I'm like, oh my god! Like I would not see Hillary Ronan there. I would not see Josh Arce there.
I've seen them at a couple of community meetings.
Yeah, community meetings, but like pre-application meetings, which are really small. They're like 20 people just for this project. I mean, unless it's like the Beast on Bryant or something like that. Mm. I don't see candidates often there.
And I don't know. I haven't been to as many as you have, but
yeah. But anyway, so I was impressed with that. And the other one is Melissa San Miguel. And I have to be a little careful about calling her an unknown candidate because I got a lot of flack for that because she apparently does have quite a track record. She served in elected office statewide as part of the Latino caucus, I believe, and a representative for a congressional district in the state. I am going to try to talk to her next week to learn more about her background. But those two are the newest addition to Hillary Ronan, Josh Arce, and Edward Lindo, who have been, you know, running since January or February. So,
yeah. So Melissa announced her candidacy just a few weeks before
Darcel Jackson. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So we'll see. I mean, it's still really early. The campaign. I mean, the election is not until November. They've already had a few events, but we'll see how it shapes up. And you can still run. You can still declare your candidacy until, I want to say, June 14th.
Oh, my
something.
Gosh. So we could have more.
We could have a lot more.
More candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for people who don't know, we have this weekly series called 43 Questions because we started asking the candidates one question a week 43 weeks before the election. We had, I believe, four to begin with. And then more and more folks started joining. So now it's a bit of a longer read every week. But, I think everyone has something interesting to say every week. So it's worth checking out. Tiny plug for Mission Local Features.
If you're interested in the election. Do you think they have interesting things to say every week? I mean, sometimes, and we've talked about this, we're just disappointed in their answers.
I guess that's true. I mean, they're always interesting from some perspective, but I think, some weeks you have more substance than others in these responses. And I think, partially it's a challenge because we are limiting candidates in a political campaign to 100 words or less,
right.
Which is really hard, I think, for people who are used to being able to state their case at length.
Cut to the chase.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
What was one of the, speaking of the 43 questions, what was one of the questions that stood out to you that was kind of a real answer from the candidates or something that was really...
I think one of them was on, it was kind of a boring topic, like height limits in the Mission, whether buildings should go above current height limits so that we can have even denser housing. People kind of hedged their bets. They were like, it's not the Mission's responsibility to build more housing, so let's talk about doing more regional housing first. And then Azuari Svanya just came out really strong and said, no, I don't like denser housing. I don't want height limits. Like, denser housing is bad. And that's like an interesting position. It's not unique. We'll see if it helps solve the housing crisis. But it was like a very clear instance of them not being on the fence about anything.
Right, taking a stance.
I wonder if that's even something that we can fairly expect. I mean, obviously that is what everybody wants from an elected official right now, is solve the housing crisis. But there has been so much talk about how enormous this crisis really is. And it's actually interesting because this group of people who are running for the District 9 seat are all, I think they would all describe themselves as fairly progressive, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Particularly progressive, yeah, maybe.
I
mean, even.
I think that's also part of the game, is like that you have to identify yourself as progressive or else you have no chance here.
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting to hear that one of their perspectives is that we should, encourage other parts of the Bay Area to increase their housing production, because that is actually something that SF BARF, a group that, so the Bay Area Renters Federation, has been advocating for pretty strongly, which generally is not so much associated with the progressives that this group kind of belongs to. It's interesting because in San Francisco, progressive means like five different things. But
yeah, I think that's actually one of the places where the city's progressives and these pro-development groups are in agreement, is like, yes, San Francisco should not bear the burden of this housing crisis.
Yeah, and one neighborhood particularly bear the burden.
But that doesn't, unless you have a plan to make Palo Alto bring housing, that's not really solving anything. Like, we all acknowledge that this is a regional issue, but, tell me how you're going to solve that or help solve the housing crisis.
Yeah, I believe there was talk of a lawsuit.
Yeah, so SF Barf started suing the suburbs. It started with Lafayette. I don't know where that lawsuit is or if they've moved on to other cities. But like, there's a state law that says that you can't strike down developments if it's a reduction in density, basically. And so they're trying out this novel approach with a lawsuit, hoping to get denser developments out in the suburbs. And we'll see.
Yeah, I just thought that was interesting because it makes me wonder if there's any possibility of having, collaboration on a multi-pronged approach to this be a point of discussion in an election for one supervisorial seat, like basically one neighborhood representative. Also in part because, like I said, this is such an enormous and complex problem, and we're essentially asking, I think, as a voter, you know, I'm basically waiting for someone to come along and give me a comprehensive plan and be like, this is how I'm going to fix this gigantic regional problem.
Right.
Vote for me as your representative for the 10 square blocks that makes up whatever neighborhoods.
Right. Yeah. And I think actually that's we should put that question to them is how, not how are you going to solve the housing crisis, but how would you work with SF Barf, for instance? Mm-hmm. Like, how would you work with these pro-development groups?
Yeah. Compromise.
Because these groups are new, but they're a reality in city life now. So,
and they have ideas.
They have ideas you have to take seriously.
Yeah.
I think in terms of housing plan, the only thing we've really seen is, you know, Hillary Rodham coming off really strong at her kickoff saying, I'm going to build 5,000 units in the next 10 years of affordable housing. That's a really strong plan. I haven't really heard any specifics yet. Everyone is very skeptical.
I mean that's always the problem with the campaign, right?
Yeah, and I mean like 5,000 units at a half a million each is $2.5 billion. So I don't know what's going on there, but I await the specifics from her campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to be waiting on specifics in a campaign for a very long time because that's just the nature of campaigns, I think, is to make as many promises that sound good to as many people as possible. And then once someone is elected, you know, they really have to show their cards and kind of indicate where they're going to go next.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Should we move on to the next topic?
Let's move on to the next topic. What's our next topic?
Okay.
What are we talking about?
Next topic is something, Laura, you reported on. It's a startup called Rentmasters. Do you want to tell us more?
That's right. So Rentmasters, it's a new startup. It launched in February, and its CEO is a man named Brian Bench, 7-year San Francisco resident. And he had this idea, basically, to tap into a niche market that was, I guess, created in this rental housing crisis that we're in. So what he's doing is connecting rent-controlled tenants and their landlords and facilitating buyouts. So that's kind
of a buyout again?
So a buyout is, you know, if a landlord and a tenant come to agreements, for example, the landlord wants the tenant to move out, and he or she approaches the tenant and makes them an offer, negotiations happen. Sometimes buyouts are a result of evictions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's...
I'll give you $50,000 if you move out tomorrow.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And how much tenants usually get? Like, did the tenants union ever tell you?
So the average right now is about $40,000.
$40,000.
But, you know, it depends on the situation. It depends on how long that person has lived in their unit. It depends on other things. You know, is this a disabled person? Is this,
right.
So there's different layers, and that can result in a higher buyout.
Right. And what are some of the highest that the tenants union has seen?
So I was told, six-figure buyouts have been negotiated.
Wow. Yeah.
So it really depends, though, and it depends on your resources. You know, it depends on how much time you have. A tenant lawyer actually told me the longer sometimes that you hang in,
of course,
the higher the amount is, and just how desperately that landlord wants that unit.
Yeah, totally.
And for the landlord, you know, on the landlord's part, it is how much can the landlord get for tearing that unit over?
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking, like, this is really chump change. So even a six-figure buyout, like $100,000, or even, like, I don't know how high it gets, like a half a million, these guys, depending on the project, are making several times that, so it's totally worth it to have that.
Right,
buyout.
It just depends on the landlord's funds, you know.
Right.
I spoke with one landlord who told me for him it wouldn't be worth it, you know, to actually offer a buyout because he doesn't have that kind of money.
Right.
And it is an investment, and so it just really depends on, you know, where that.
So what is Rentmasters doing?
So it's a startup, they have online services. To me, it seems like one of those tax services that you can use around tax time. You kind of pay like a down payment and they'll walk you through the process, and you file online. So that's like the most basic tier of Rentmaster service. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to go a little bit more in-depth, a little bit more fancy, Rentmasters will actually help you negotiate, help you with the contract, whatever, have face-to-face or on-phone interactions with your landlord for a commission. Mm-hmm. And the commission ranges from 10 to 20% of the buyout. Mm-hmm. So this has obviously caused
What is the controversy here?
The controversy is, you know, housing, it's when I first started working on this story, it seemed that a lot of housing activists and tenant groups didn't really know what Rentmasters was. It's so new, you know, and they had seen similar services before. Deepa Varma of the Tenants Union, mm-hmm. the executive director, actually told me, yeah, this happened, you know, with people capitalizing on mortgages, you know, or whatever. Like, this is something that happens whenever there's a crisis. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurs jump in, businessmen jump in, and want to make money out of it.
Mm-hmm. The middlemen arrive.
So exactly. And that's exactly what Bench, the CEO, calls himself. He is a middleman.
Uh-huh. But he says he's optimizing this, right? Like,
right.
What is, yeah.
So for him, you know, it's obviously he knew this was going to be a touchy subject. And he even disclaimed on his website, he said, this is targeting a certain group of people. I am not targeting the artists, the starving artists, the long-time rent-controlled tenants, you know, the older ladies or whatever. That's mm-hmm. not his point. He said he wants to target the small group of renters who came here, landed a rent-controlled apartment, came here for a job, that job is over now, came here for college is over, and they want to move out.
Right.
And so...
So did we ever learn if... This is a situation where the tenants are actually approaching the landlord saying, hey, I'm thinking about moving, but I might stay. Do you maybe have something to sweeten the deal for me?
Who goes to Rentmasters?
I wish I could have found a tenant in that position. I did not for this story, but I did talk to a landlord. Uh-huh. And I talked to, you know, several lawyers as well, and I was told that, yeah, you know, there are tenants who initiate buyouts.
Really?
There are tenants who whose life is... going a different path, you know, and they're not wanting to live in the city anymore. They don't want to rent anymore. They want to start a family and whatever. They don't want to put their kid in school here.
And does it work? I mean, like, are there people who initiate buyouts who then in fact get them?
So this one landlord that I talked to, uh-huh. who actually is, you know, renting or has tenants in the Mission, he told me that if his tenants came up to him and said $20,000 is the difference between us leaving tomorrow and us staying indefinitely, he would consider it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Because that's, you know, even though he didn't approach them or he doesn't really mm-hmm. need to turn that unit around, if it's just $20,000,
that
might be an investment for him that's
totally.
Worth thinking about.
I mean, a rent-controlled unit can, like, you could bump it up several thousand dollars a month now.
Exactly.
So it pays off in a year.
Yeah.
Like, it's totally worth it.
So he did, you know, I was told from different sources that is something that's going on. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the housing activists don't really want to put that out there.
Do you think this is actually a big threat for rent control tenants, or is it just like a nice headline, like, oh, here comes an app, a startup, like trying to get in the middle of this housing crisis?
I think it could be both. You know, I do think that there is some level of threat because, you know, there is a fear. You know, a lot of people are living with uncertainty and fear, and, you know, I remember if it was Deepa or someone else, but someone from that side, from the mm-hmm. advocate side, told me, well, what if this is an old lady, you know, and she's mm-hmm. freaking out and she doesn't know where to turn or whatever. And, mm-hmm.
and she Googles buyouts and she finds Rentmasters,
right.
And then she ends up taking a buyout when she didn't need to and could have stayed forever.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Someone actually called this an abuse magnet.
Mm-hmm.
or someone, you know, whose first language isn't English.
Well,
and
could Rentmasters, for instance, partner with the tenants union or something so that if they get this old lady, they say, okay, you're not really the client we're looking for.
And that's where, you know, that's where it could get muddled, I guess. Uh-huh. But yeah, so Bench of Rentmasters actually just, you know, said on his website, I do want to share my data with Tenants Union, with the Rent Board. I contacted both of these institutions, mm-hmm. entities, and none of them, you know, had heard from him. Mm-hmm. So, and it didn't sound like they were too open.
Yeah. And I mean, the other problem is that then you're still relying on this guy who is in it for the profit at the end of the day.
And I guess the final word from that side was there does not need to be a middleman. Mm-hmm. Like, this is mm-hmm. something that can be negotiated either if it gets serious with a lawyer, with a tenant lawyer.
Right, the middleman should be a lawyer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Which
it doesn't need to be.
It doesn't seem like Rentmasters employs any at the moment or
no. So
will
he has,
in the future?
He told me Bench has no legal background. He's mm-hmm. Has a marketing background. You know, he was a developer, and you know, but he did say he spoke to dozens of lawyers and he has attorney friends, and that's where he gets his advice, you know, and his counsel. And he would also refer clients out if it gets too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, that's a complicated situation. It's interesting because rent control is already such a touchy subject. And I think for landlords, I'm sure it can be difficult to fathom sometimes how much more rent they could be making or how much more income they could be having for their building.
Right.
If their tenants were not rent controlled, especially if they're long-term tenants. And I mean, even if they're just, you know, here in the last 5-6 years, rents have increased a lot, as absolutely. Of course everybody already knows. And I'm sure that there are landlords who are struggling to keep up with the maintenance cost of their building, especially if it's an old building. And I'm sure that problem is compounded if you have an old building with old tenants in it, because then, you know, you have some sort of obligation, especially if they're seniors or if they have disabilities or if they have really deep roots in the mission or something like that, to keep them in place.
Right.
You know, you don't want to be that person that then a witch hunt is started after. But on the other hand, if you're making, I don't know, $700 a month for off one apartment, but that might just not pencil out anymore. So I'm curious. If there are kind of silent landlord forces
behind this,
encouraging this kind of service, just because it does make the buyout process easier. And I'm sure that if there's a middleman, I mean, the middleman by nature is in the middle. And so they might not have a declared side. I mean, it sounds like Bench was saying he would go to bat, I think it said in your story, for the tenants. But I'm sure to make this a viable service, you have to be clear with the landlords, too, that you want to make something that's mutually beneficial.
Right.
Like, this is about deal making, right? Like, everybody needs to feel like they came out on top. And it sounds like the fear is from the tenant advocacy side that people may feel they came out on top, but actually gave up something that they'll never be able to get back again, which is an apartment in San Francisco.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, something that Deepa Varma of the Tenants Union also, she kind of related a story about a friend who, you know, accepted a $50,000 buyout, moved out. You know, she's a single mom, kind of blew through her buyout or her relocation bonus in 2 years. You know, and now is facing eviction from her new house in Berkeley.
Right.
Oof. So it's like, you know, it's a cycle, and I totally understand that they're cautious and they're worried. And, you know, Bench does say on his website, we are empowering tenants. Mm-hmm. So he's taking a very clear stance. This is for tenants, but obviously there are different.
It has to be for both. Otherwise it doesn't work as a negotiation service.
You know, it's a little misleading, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder. I mean, I also wonder if, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out, right? I mean, we'll have to see if he does indeed make a concerted effort to turn away clients that might not be the best fit because they're giving up something that they actually have a right to hold on to legally, and B, because if they negotiated, even if it sounded like a big sum, they'd actually be screwing themselves, essentially.
Right, and if they don't know better, and they don't have an attorney by
their side. That's the other interesting thing is, I mean, if we're talking about Bay Area rentals, right? I mean, like, $50,000 sounds like a lot of money just on the face of it, but like this case, this example mm-hmm. illustrated that you gave, it's really not, if you're going to think long-term and like living somewhere. It's definitely not enough for a down payment.
Involved, right.
Yeah.
And then a down payment, yeah. moving costs as well.
Yeah.
So it's,
and if you have a family, I mean, you need more than just a studio somewhere in the East Bay. I mean, I'm sure it disappears very quickly. I mean, it doesn't sound like this woman in the example squandered the money she was given. It sounds like that's just the nature of things in the Bay Area.
No, I think, and that was one of the points brought up, you know, if you are planning on starting a new life, or you do not expect to live in San Francisco or the Bay Area after this, mm-hmm. this deal, it might be a good option because you have $50,000, you can, whatever, be on your way, go travel, do whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if you expect to live here, you know, that is definitely not.
Alternatively, if you're the kind of person who is thinking about buying a house and settling down in the suburbs, and you are financially able to do that, are you also the kind of person who should be pursuing a buy? I mean, I suppose you should always be pursuing, you know, the most money that you can get.
Just squeeze it. Yeah.
But that's also the other interesting thing is, like, this now, this is a service essentially for the people who already have some degree of means.
Right.
Being compensated for something in a way that is, I think, intended for people with little means.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's the biggest thing, is the people with little means, they don't really benefit because, as you said, if they're probably going to move elsewhere in the Bay Area. I mean, they have lives in right. this region. So the 50,000 or whatever, they're going to blow through it like that. And the people who are moving, like, to Chicago or, you know, somewhere else.
Because Chicago's cheap.
Or, you know, like, Arizona or something cheap. They already are going to do that. Like, they are just squeezing as much as they can out of their rent-controlled unit.
Right. Which, I mean, you know, by rights, given San Francisco law, you totally should. But yeah. I wonder if that is the intention
that's,
behind the way the law was written. And I suspect sound like it's not.
It does not sound like it.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah.
But hey, I mean, like, you know, he, the founder of this
Bench,
startup,
yeah.
Bench, thank you. I think you said in your article the group of people that he's looking to target is very small, but it's not zero.
It's not zero. He said as long as it's not zero.
Yeah. So there, and, I mean, there must be people out there yeah. who want to do this and for whom
and
it
also,
is a reasonable service.
He also
service.
Said, I didn't include this in the article, but he also said that, you know, he doesn't expect, because I asked him, you know, what's your company like? How many people are working for you? Where are you at? And he said, I'm not expecting to grow exponentially. I'm not expecting, mm-hmm. he wants to keep it a small operation. You know, so he's definitely, he's a startup, but he's not on that startup hype of growing and getting bigger. And, you know, he said he just wants to kind of tap into this market and we'll see what happens. And he also said he's here now and mm-hmm. things might change. Right. He's very aware and he's going with yeah. the flow right now.
Yeah. Did he mention what would happen if the bubble burst?
We did not. But he said he's doing what he has to do now.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've heard this before, that just if there were an extreme bubble bursting event and everything crashed, it doesn't necessarily mean that rents would plummet yes. immediately, right?
I think it's called a ratchet effect. Yeah, and like the last time the bubble burst, rents kind of took a little downturn and then they kept rising.
I mean, yeah, San Francisco is expensive and yeah. has always been expensive.
And it's a peninsula. Like, it's always going right. to be more expensive.
Yeah, yeah, you're a little bit limited by water. Unless we all start living on houseboats.
What a way to leave this off, you guys. Yeah. Jesus, there's no hope.
And with that, we will end the show. We'll be back 2 weeks from now with our regularly scheduled programming of news and notes from the neighborhood. You've been tuned in to Listen Local, brought to you by the staff of Mission Local. If you know something we don't that you think we should, shoot us an email at info@missionlocal.com. When we're out, you should check out some indie tunes and more from across the pond, brought to you by John Digital. Thanks for listening.